So I had a friend, I think it was middle school, but I'm not entirely sure. I'll call her Deborah, but that wasn't her name. And we were pretty good friends, and it was one of these kind of middle school friendships where, like, all of a sudden you're, like, BFFs, right? You're, like, doing everything together, and I was calling her, like, we were talking on the phone, we would do stuff, and then, like, a couple months later, we kind of stopped hanging out as much. We kind of had different circles of friends, and I didn't see her as much, which didn't bother me, but it apparently bothered her. So she called me up one night after we had kind of drifted apart a little bit, and she was angry at me and hurt, and she said these words that just struck me. I mean, I was like seventh grade or something, so these are like, this is high drama. She told me, "You have hurt me more than anyone else ever in the entire world."
Wow.
I know, right? In seventh grade, and it was like we were friends and we weren't friends, and I was like, wow, I had no idea. And I hope that's, like, well, let's see. What I want to say, I hope that's still true for her, because then her life would hopefully have been pretty good if a little seventh grade friendship change was still her most significant hurt. But I think I kind of understand. I mean, friendships, you're kind of close to somebody, and then you're not close anymore, and something happens. And there wasn't this major rift between us, but it was a good friend that stopped being a good friend. And that is painful. There's something just about that where you want to be close to somebody and you're not, whether it's a friend, sometimes it's a romantic relationship, but that pain of wanting to be with somebody where you can't is real. And that's a little bit what we're going to be talking about here tonight. It's an issue that's real for us. I know it's an issue that's real even for people in this room. I've had conversations with a lot of you guys about painful, broken relationships. Some of them are within YAF. Some of them are with other believers. And that can be one of the hardest things, I think. I'm actually preparing a sermon series for the main service in Colossians right now. And one of the issues that is in Colossians is Paul praises the Colossians for their love for each other and basically says that's an indication of their relationship with God. And it has struck me in studying this how it's harder to love each other. It's harder to love in this room. It's harder to love the people we're close to, we spend time with, because we have the opportunity to hurt each other. We have the opportunity to disappoint each other, to misunderstand each other, to misrepresent each other. We have all sorts of opportunities to hurt and to cause pain for each other. So sometimes the love amidst a group of Christian people can be harder. It's easy to go kind of love maybe the people you work with because your relationship only stays at a certain level. They don't really have the opportunity to cause you significant pain. But when you're close to somebody, there's more of that. So I think it's significant then that the biblical story and what we're doing in this series is looking at the whole biblical story. We're looking from creation to the final redemption, and we're kind of looking at different episodes. So I think it's no accident that one of the most significant events in the Bible for God's people had to do with a broken relationship, with essentially a community that was splintered. And I'd like to suggest that this is probably one of the most tragic divisions of a group of people that has ever happened in the history of the world. It sounds kind of like my seventh grade drama. This is the most hurt. But I think it is, because it's God's people. It's His chosen nation, and they have been divided into north and south. So if you recall, this is our little handy-dandy little chart that we've been kind of following as we've been doing this. If you don't have one of these or you've lost it, there's more on the back table. So last week we talked about success. And if you were here, then you were declared a success. I hope you still have your little diplomas. But if you look, we're kind of, the biblical story's been going up. Things with David got really, really good. And now they're going to get really, really bad. So we're kind of on the way down here. They're not as bad as they're going to get. That's next time. But they're pretty bad tonight. This is the beginning of kind of one of the harder seasons for God's people. So I just want to kind of remind us and point out about this story, the importance of us kind of getting our own lives wrapped up in this story. It's just struck me in preparing for this series and thinking about this, how much this story is our stories and how the story that God has told in the scripture really, all the different points relate to us in different ways. And I've been thinking, I just kind of, you know, out and driving or looking around, and I just wonder, I know there's a lot of reasons, but I wonder why people don't believe. And I'd like to have, I wish I could have more conversations about this with people. Like, why don't you believe this Christian story? Because it strikes me that it's really the best thing out there. I mean, this story has all of our experience wrapped up in it. It has the tragedy, it has the reality, it has the depth of hurt, but it has hope, it has redemption, it has reconciliation. This story that God is telling, that he invites people into by faith in Jesus, is, I think, the story we all want. It's the story we want to be a part of. Deep down, I think everybody longs to be a part of this big picture, and yet people don't. And I don't know, you know, everybody's got reasons. I think people find it hard sometimes to realize that this story is what they want. I think one of the reasons I've wanted to do this series is because I think this is really the, another word for what we're doing is the gospel. I mean, this story is the gospel. This is the message that God brings to the world. And if you, it's interesting, if you read in the New Testament, when Peter and Paul, there's a couple occasions where we actually get the record of them preaching the gospel. And it reads kind of like this series. It starts with God's people, and it goes through some of their tragedy and some of their pain and some of their mistakes, and it ends with the redemption of God. It's not a lot like the way we present the gospel when and if we do, kind of all about you and you're separated from God and Jesus died for your sins and this very kind of individual. When the New Testament apostles present the gospel, they present this big picture and they say, this is what God is doing through his people, through Jesus, and you have the opportunity to enter into this story. And so I think sometimes people don't realize that this is what Christians believe. This is what it's all about. So tonight we're at kind of one of the low points in the story. And if you've done any, like, I don't know, ninth grade English class or anything, you know, you've studied stories, you know, like most stories have a problem. You kind of start out, there's a setting, there's a problem, and then you start to get to the solution. But we're in the problem part of the story right now. We're finding out what is wrong. And part of what the problem part of the story does is it sets you up for what is going to be solved. So one of the things we're looking at tonight, and the reason it's important to understand this, is because this is what God is fixing. The situation we're going to look at tonight is what God is repairing through his work in the world. Okay, so that's enough intro. Let's get into it. Last week was David. David was king of Israel. He passed on his kingship to his son Solomon. Solomon's king, the years under Solomon were pretty good, although Solomon started to drift. This event we're looking at now happens right after Solomon. Solomon has a son. His name is Rehoboam. And Rehoboam receives the kingship, but he has an opportunity to talk to God's people. He has an opportunity to decide how to be king. And the choice he makes ends up sending most of the nation away. He ends up losing most of his power. So I'm going to be reading a little bit of the story. It's a long story, so we can't read it all, but I'm going to read from 1 Kings 12. I'm going to read 16 to 20. So what happens is, And if you were in service, I don't know, a month ago or so, this is one of the stories I told as part of the series that I was preaching at that point.
Jerry and Ronnie.
Jerry and
thank you. Like,
Roger. Exactly. Rehoboam and Jeroboam are the
like,
two guys.
Yeah, here? Got it.
Yeah. So I called them Jerry and Roger because those names are easier. So Roger was actually Solomon's son. And then what happened is Solomon was really hard on the people of Israel. That's why he had fabulous temples and palaces built, because he forced them to build them. Kind of like Katie with her zoo. Solomon had a great life. Solomon's people, not so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Exactly. So what happened is when Solomon's son became king, they said, hey, if you go a little bit easier on us, we will be loyal subjects to you forever. We will serve you. And so Rehoboam, or Roger, goes to the older people, his older advisors, and says, what should I do? And they say, anybody remember?
Yeah, be nice.
Be nice. Thank you. The older people are wise. They say, be nice. Then he goes and talks to his younger advisors. And what do they say?
Be harder.
Be harder on them. They say this great line. I'm not going to be able to find it quickly. But yeah, here it is. Tell them my little finger is thicker than my father's waist. Isn't that nice? That's interesting. So Rehoboam ends up taking the advice of the younger people. He comes to the people of Israel and he says this. You thought my father was hard. Wait till you see me. And because of that, they leave. So we're going to pick up now. Now we're in verse 16. When all Israel saw that the king refused to listen to them, they answered the king, what share do we have in David? What part in Jesse's son? To your tents, O Israel. Look after your own house, O David. So the Israelites went home. But as for the Israelites who were living in the towns of Judah, Rehoboam still ruled over them. King Rehoboam sent out Adoniram, who was in charge of forced labor, but all Israel stoned him to death. Of course they did. King Rehoboam, however, managed to get into his chariot and escape to Jerusalem. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. When all the Israelites heard that Jeroboam had returned, they sent and called him to the assembly and made him king over all Israel. Only the tribe of Judah remained loyal to the house of David. Now, all these names, I think, can get kind of confusing because we think of Israel as Israel, but now there's Israel and Judah, and there's different kings. So David, the house of David, reigns from Jerusalem. And what's happened now is the northern part of the country has split off. And now they're called Israel, and the southern part is called Judah. Yes? Does this sound vaguely familiar if you're ever in Sunday school? Right? So Rehoboam is still king in Jerusalem over the part of the country called Judah, and Jeroboam is king over the part of the country that's now referred to as Israel. So Jeroboam is the king of Israel, Rehoboam is the king of Judah. So what split? Why did the country get split? Summarize this. What was the motivation? What did Rehoboam do? What motivated him?
Power.
Power. Yeah, basically. Anything else? Anything else? Other ways to describe it?
Pride, I guess a bit. Mm-hmm. Didn't want to appear weaker than Solomon. Mm-hmm.
Selfishness, maybe?
Kind of bravado, thinking he could get away with it instead of thinking that people would just leave.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. This is a quote from T.S. Eliot. He says, half the harm that is done in this world is due to people who want to feel important. They don't mean to do harm, but the harm does not interest them, or they do not see it, or they justify it, because they are absorbed in the endless struggle to think well of themselves. So I think this picture of Rehoboam and Jeroboam and this split, this division that kind of tore apart God's people is probably something that we can resonate with in our own lives in smaller types of circumstances, right? We have acted towards people out of pride, out of power, selfishness, self-interest, not caring about somebody else. And when that happens, divisions happen, failure, broken relationships. So what happens in a community when there's a big relational split? What develops?
Alliances?
Yeah, alliances. Two sides, right? This person's side, that person's side. And this is something, you know, if you just look around the world, everywhere you go, you'll see two camps, right? Two camps of people. I was preparing this message at a coffee shop, and I was on my little Windows PC and saw like this line of MacBooks. And I'm like, maybe I should become a Mac person, you know? I mean, it's not even like, it's not like about the type of computer you own. It's like an identity, you know? It's like a conversion experience. Like, maybe I do want to go to the other side. It's this dramatic thing, right? There are two camps of computers. It's not just like which one you prefer. And you can't actually talk to anybody about it, because if you do, it becomes this like, oh, it's the best. It's like this really high, you know, everybody. I know we have a Microsoft employee. So don't worry. I decided not to. So you don't have to worry.
It's better. It's better.
See?
It's more expensive.
But I mean, we just have, like, no matter where you look, we have two camps, right? And this is why I think we like sports teams. This is why Mark wants to be an NFL quarterback, because he wants to win for his team and beat the other team. And you know, whatever it is, there's always, and it, you know, it happens in petty ways, but it happens in really significant ways too, right? And look around the world, look at global politics, and you see any country usually has two camps. Our own country, Republicans and Democrats, there's division. And I remember thinking about this, studying it in high school, like, you kind of think, well, why don't we just not have two parties? Like, it seems to cause so many problems. Why don't you just not do it? And of course, the teacher's like, well, I don't know. You just can't not do it. That's just the way it is. And I think it is the way it is. We tend to split. We tend to divide. So, this picture then, this part of Israel's story, this part of the biblical story is something that's significant to us. We know about it. We know about it in our own lives. We know about it in the world. One of the questions we'll be talking about in our small groups tonight is to think about a significant relational split that you've gone through or you've experienced. As I was preparing this, I couldn't help but be thinking about marriage and divorce. And, you know, what I do a lot with people in small groups and stuff is tell life stories. And for people whose parents are divorced, that is always a significant issue for them in their life. I mean, that is a chapter, that is an event, that is a historic, that affects people. And now sometimes it's more dramatic, more painful than other times, but the breaking up of your parents is a major event. And I know some of you have divorced parents, and it's, my wife's parents are divorced, and I think there's always this, they're actually separated for a long time before they got divorced, and there's always this hope she had. There's always this hope in the back of her mind that something could happen, that maybe somehow they get back together. Even after they actually got divorced, even after her father married another woman, there's always, I think, in the back of her mind, like, what if that could be fixed? What if this major rift that I've experienced could be healed? And that's what God's people experience. They experience this broken relationship. And then basically, ever from that point on, everybody talks about the day when Israel and Judah will be reunited. Everybody talks about when the 12 tribes of Israel will all come back together, when they'll all be under one king. There's a ton of examples. I thought I'd read at least one to prove to you that I know what I'm talking about. This is Isaiah 5, 7. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are the garden of his delight. And he looked for justice but saw bloodshed. for righteousness, but heard cries of distress. This is God's grief over the two, over the north and south that were split. Let me read it again, because this actually makes a different point than I said it made. But the point it makes is how pained God is over the split of his people. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are the garden of his delight. And he looked for justice, but saw bloodshed, for righteousness, but heard cries of distress. They're meant to be together, and they're not. So, here's what happens, though. We have two groups of people that are broken, that are split in their relationship. But that's actually not the real problem. That's actually not the real problem that the biblical story is carrying us along with. The real problem is the split between people and God. But this division of people against people, is something that demonstrates the distance that people feel with God. It demonstrates the separation. It points to, it's a symptom of the separation between God and his people. So, listen to this. This is 1 Kings 12, 25 to 29. This is what happens. Then Jeroboam, remember this is the king in the north, fortified Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and lived there. From there he went out and built up Peniel. So, he's a new king. He's now being king over a country that used to have its headquarters in Jerusalem. So he's got to go figure out his own new capital, build his own new king's palace, right? This is what he's doing. Now Jeroboam thought to himself, the kingdom will now likely revert to the house of David. That's back in Jerusalem. If these people go up to offer sacrifices at the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, they will again give their allegiance to their lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah. They will kill me and return to King Rehoboam. So after seeking advice, the king made two golden calves. He said to the people, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. One he set up in Bethel, which is the far southern part of his kingdom, and the other in Dan, which is the far northern part of his kingdom. And this thing became a sin. It's an understatement. The people went even as far as Dan to worship the one there. So what's he doing? Why does he do this? Why does he build these calves?
So they don't go back to the other king.
Yeah. So where is a Jew supposed to worship?
Jerusalem,
at the temple, right? This is the only place to offer a sacrifice. The only place for the people of God to worship God is where he has chosen to make his dwelling. That's Jerusalem. So Jeroboam reasons, well, at some point they're going to want to go make a sacrifice. They're going to go down there and they'll just decide, hey, it's just easier to pledge allegiance to this king. And they'll end up killing me and the game's over. So he says, what I have to do is I have to make an alternate way for them to worship, or else my kingdom will never survive. They can't be going down to Jerusalem to worship. So what does he make?
Calves.
Ironically, golden calves. Ring some bells, right? Golden calves. What does he say about them? These are the gods that brought you out of Egypt. The same exact thing that Aaron said of the golden calf that he made right after Yahweh, the true God of Israel, led his people out of Egypt. Aaron builds a calf and says, this is the God that led you out of Egypt. So this relational split causes the people in the northern kingdom to fall away from God. They can't worship anymore. Their king says, this is where you need to go worship. You need to go worship these calves. And what he's doing is he's rewriting the story. Right? He says, this is the God that brought you out of Egypt. He uses the same story, the story we've been talking about. Remember, Egypt was deliverance. It was about a God who delivers us. And he says, well, yeah, the story's the same, but the character is different. He rewrites it. And so the northern tribes of Israel end up having a very hard time being true to Yahweh. Some of the kings are actually decent. Some of them remove the shrines. Some of them actually promote worship of Yahweh, but few of them. This actually, just kind of as a side note, this is part of the issue. Do you remember when Jesus was walking through Samaria and the woman at the well, she asked him this question about where we're supposed to worship? This is the background of that. Samaria was the capital of the northern tribes. And so the debate about where you're supposed to worship became a huge issue for the northern tribes and the southern tribes. So this is the issue that she's referring to when she asks Jesus. So even, you can tell, I mean, hundreds of years later, that's about 1,000 years later, it's still an issue. Where are we supposed to worship? So what happens then is, because these people are so focused on staying away from each other, on fortifying their own kingdoms, how can you possibly focus on God in the midst of that? God becomes secondary. And so you're separated from God. And that's the real tragedy. That's what happens in our lives. When we experience relational division, or strife, when our relationships fail, what happens is we're pulled away from God because we're so focused on this pain, this drama. We're so focused on protecting ourselves or avenging ourselves or whatever it is. We end up forgetting about God. But it also doesn't have to be that way. Because one of the things that this event did was it gave the people of Israel something to hope for. It reminded them that they needed to return to God. The relational division they experienced was like a constant reminder that something was wrong. We're not right with God. Things are not the way they're supposed to be. Things aren't right. And so it, in a sense, reminded them to turn back to God. I don't know for myself, I think that probably, and I've shared this part of my story a couple different times, but my wife and I went through a really difficult series in our marriage, a really difficult season, where we were fighting and couldn't reconcile and couldn't figure out what was happening. And I think if we hadn't had been believers, we probably would have divorced, because it just didn't seem like there was much of an option for us. We ended up going through a pretty significant period of time with doing marriage counseling, and that was the gift of God to us. And it was really only by God's grace and his working in us that we stayed together. But one of the things that did happen in that season is I experienced God in a new way. Because kind of when things were going fine, I thought everything was fine. But as soon as my marriage was in trouble, I realized, without wanting to, that I was broken, that I was a mess. That, you know, I'd grown up Christian, I was a Christian leader, I was in seminary at the time. Like, I'm supposed to be able to keep my marriage healthy, right? That, like, God's on my side. I'm the good guy here. I'm supposed to be able to make this work. And I couldn't. So it was this reminder that something is wrong. That you need God. That you're not all that. That you're not as good a husband as you might think you are. And so it became this time for me to really return to God and say, God, I do need you, and I don't know what's going on, and I need to be comforted by you, I need to be led by you. And so relationships, broken relationships, can be an opportunity as well. And that's what we're going to see as we progress in the story, that this becomes an opportunity for God to intervene, for God to be at work. I'm going to read just a couple more passages, because it also becomes an opportunity for some of the kings. So there's a king several years later named Josiah. Josiah was a very good king. He ended up commissioning some people to rebuild the temple because the temple had fallen into disarray. When he did that, they discovered the book of the law, probably Deuteronomy. And they said, oh, look, this thing looks important. We've never read this. So they brought it out to Josiah, and they said, hey, look, we found this book. It looks like it's talking to us from God. It's kind of cool. So they read it to Josiah, and he tore his robes because he thought, oh my God, I had no idea that this is how we were supposed to be living. So he throws up this great Passover. 2 Kings says that he had the best Passover celebration that basically had ever been in existence. I'm forgetting exactly where that is. And it's pretty remarkable. 2 Kings 23, I'll just read one verse, 25. Listen to this statement about Josiah. This is going to be the night of superlatives, by the way. Neither before nor after Josiah was there a king like him who turned to the Lord as he did, with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his strength, in accordance with the law of Moses. So Josiah, if you read this rightly, even surpassed King David, right? Never before was there a king like this, and never after. This is an amazing statement. I actually found this. My sister had a son and named him Josiah, and I was like, oh, that sounds vaguely biblical. I think I was in seminary at the time, so I shouldn't know. So I was like, oh yeah, I looked it up, and I was like, wow, Josiah was the best king ever. That's even better than David. Cool name. So anyway, Josiah was a good guy. But then, of course, Josiah had a son, Jehoahaz. Verse 31, Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 3 months. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, just as his fathers had done. So the cycle continues. Good king, bad king. Good king, bad king. Up, down, back and forth. But because the nation had walked so far away from God, Josiah was able to return them. He was able to enter into this opportunity and bring people back to experience God. So, the point tonight, the point of what we're looking at, is to realize that when we experience broken relationship, that this is part of God's story. This is part of what God's people experience. It's not meant to be that way, but it's reality. This is the way it is. When it happens, it's a tragedy. It's not the way God intends it to be. But it's also an opportunity. It's an opportunity for God to intervene. It's an opportunity for us to realize that this is what God is fixing. This is the situation that God is in the process of fixing. And we as Christians have the ability to approximate that, to do some of that now. We have the possibility to reconcile with each other in ways that people who don't know God simply don't have. We know true forgiveness. And that is immensely powerful. And I know sometimes it's hard to believe, and sometimes we don't think we can do it with each other. And it's hard. It's hard work. It's not just say a prayer and great, all right, let's go to the movies. You know, it's more complicated than that. Relationships are hard work, reconciling, addressing all the issues. But God's in it, and He can do it.